Author of the Week with Alex Lefchuk and, of course, another sensationally talented purveyor of perfect prose.
But who's the author?
Let's find out.
Winner of the Ryan Award for Best Book in Racing Literature. Clearly an accolade which is well worth celebrating. And indeed, when you focus on the adventures of the fabulous Nicky Luttrell, you can only actually look at the creator, somebody who's been involved as an amateur jockey and indeed racehorse breeder for much of her life. It's the wonderful Sasa Hill. How are you, Sasa?
I'm good. I'm very happy now that we've got enough technical glitches out of the way that we can carry on. And I thank you very much for having me on here today. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's an absolute joy. And of course, as somebody who's been described very much as a latest incarnation of Dick Francis, your love is clearly within the wonderful world of horse racing, it would seem.
Very much so. I loved being a breeder. I loved owning racehorses. The highs and the lows associated with that are really, it's a roller coaster ride. It's really wild. And when your horse that you bred yourself and you help pull out of his mother comes down the lane on the lead and wins the race, there is nothing else like that in the world. I've never experienced a bigger thrill than that.
Well, certainly we in Britain have actually had a whole range of experiences from obviously Royal Ascot through to the Grand National, through to all of the sort of areas. I've actually quite been over to the Kentucky Derby, but that's another line entirely. From somebody who's based in South Carolina, is that historically an area that clearly, when it comes to horse racing, it's one of the sort of key aspects of the states?
It is. Because Aiken, where I live, was established as a town by the very wealthy, the Whitneys and the Vanderbilts and people like that in America in the late 1800s. And they established it as a place to winter their horses, which also meant it was a place, and still is, where you can get your yearlings and two-year-olds fit, because it's a sandy land. The ground never freezes in the winter. So a lot of people send their horses down here for the winter season.
I love the quote, you want to create a world that's a bit scary, sometimes funny, always informative, and a reliable destination for escape. That tends to sum up the emotions that probably one goes through if you are actually keen to follow the whole area of horse racing in general, I would have thought.
It does. And I don't think there's ever been a year where we need a place to escape more than this recent year with the pandemic. I mean, it's great to have a book that carries you away and takes you someplace else where there is a love for animals and a love for excitement and mystery and action. I think it's very helpful to people to have a place to escape. I mean, I think even in good times, it's good to have a place to escape.
Now, Nicky Luttrell is clearly the main protagonist of your Nicky Luttrell mystery series and novels. Clearly, women jockeys have been growing in prominence over the years. Was that something you always had in mind in terms of, yes, I'm not going to write about a male jockey, it's going to be a female jockey, obviously?
Definitely. And I wanted her to go through some of the things that female jockeys did go through with the little tiny closets they had to change in, and then later on, the women's jockey rooms. They had the men had a big showers and masseuses and all these things. And the women at least at Pimlico Racetrack in Baltimore had like a little tiny hot box shower that would burn your feet. And that was it. That's what they had. So they've had a lot to overcome. They really have. Including the fact that a lot of the males initially looked down upon the female riders, but they don't anymore. They're getting along great now. And I think there's a lot of mutual respect that wasn't there initially.
Your first book, of course, Full Mortality, was published back in 2010. Was writing something that was always in the blood? Was it something you always felt drawn to as a way of communicating adventures and stories?
Well, I love to write, and I didn't think that I was much of a writer because when I was a kid, I read all of the Black Stallion books, by Farley, and I loved them. And when I was in the fifth grade, our teacher had us asked everybody to write a little piece of a story. And all the children, because we were kids, they groaned. And I wrote this little piece of about a boy in a horse trailer with an older trainer. It was very much like the Henry Daly and the star, the protagonist of the Black Stallion books. But something happened. I don't remember. I wrote it so long ago. And at the end, the teacher liked it so much, she read it out loud to the class. Actually, it was worse than that. She made me read it out loud to the class. So I did. And when I finished, everybody was raising their hands. And I thought, what? And I said, what? And they said, what happens next? And there is nothing that a writer can ever hear that is more rewarding than that, that somebody actually wants to know what happens next. So that's when I began to think, well, maybe I can write. And so I did write, but I didn't write my first novel till 2010, as you just said. It took me a while.
And you also have an interesting connection with arguably America's first female sports writer. That, of course, is the wonderful Rhoda Christmas Bowling. Would you actually just expand a little bit more on that role?
Oh, I loved her. She actually taught me how to ride. She had horses at a beautiful place called Belfield in Maryland. And she put me on my first horse, and her niece, Kitsy Christmas, you may have heard of, there was Edward Christmas that had the famous female racehorse. Her name is escaping me at the moment, but she was legendary. And her father was the trainer of that horse. And Kitsy spent time at up at Saratoga and at Delaware Park. She had a pony. And so between Kitsy and I rode together for years, and we've been best friends for years. So through that family, I met so many wonderful people involved in the horse business. I met Alfred H. Smith, who had the leading steeplechase trainer for 2 years in a row, Eclipse Award-winning steeplechase horse, rather. And that was, he took me under his wing when I was 16. My father died, and Al Smith took me under his wing, and Rhoda still had me under her wing. And I was very lucky. I was very lucky to know these people and to be drawn into that horse world through them.
There's a big difference, of course, between horse racing in terms of, as its name suggests, racing horses, and three-day eventing, and the notion of dressage and cross-country and show jumping. Were you ever tempted to actually take on board some of the other equine specialists, or has it always been racing for yourself?
It's always been racing. I rode in a couple of horse shows and won some ribbons, but it was too slow and controlled for me. I was always the one who wanted to go racing across country, jumping everything to get to the next field and crashing through, you know, ravines and back up the hill and into the next field. I love the adventure of just going fast on a horse and covering a lot of ground. And when I was a little kid, I loved all the Westerns, you know, the Roy Rogers movies where everybody's galloping around like crazy on horses throughout the entire movie. And I used to watch those movies on a rocking horse that my parents gave me when I was a little tiny kid. And I would be galloping on that racehorse right along with everybody in the movie. So I was destined to ride fast. And I remember one of my riding instructor said to me, "You're a speed freak." And I said, "Well, yeah, I guess I am." So that was me. So of course, horse racing would be what I loved.
And in terms of your horse riding exploits and so on, fallen off many times, or is that a case if we just don't talk about it?
Oh, sure. I fell off times when Al Smith gave me my first horse to go fox hunting on. And I passed the master a number of times until we got the proper bit in the horse's mouth. And the funny thing is, I went down with that horse quite a few times, but I never fell off of him but one time. We would always sort of go down together. I don't know what that was all about. And I remember one time I was riding in a hunt, and there was a telephone pole with it. You know, they have those guide wires that go down to the ground to anchor the telephone pole. And we were galloping through the woods and I caught my ankle on the guide wire and I threw both the horse and myself down on the ground. And I remember it was Al Smith's daughter, Marilyn, who looked at me because my upper lip had started to crumble and I was getting ready to cry. And she just yelled at me. She said, "You get back on that horse right now." And I did. We just kept going. So those, my falls were, I was very lucky. I never got seriously hurt. And I was always ridiculously brave. I'm not now, I'm older. And I realized that I was almost suicidal at times, but I had a ton of bravery and gusto and just bring it on.
And Nikki Luttrell, clearly somebody who is very close to your heart, your fictional alter ego, one might well say, already up to book five, wonderfully entitled Shooting Star, kind of puts together both the movie world and the horse racing world, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And what prompted me to write this was, I don't know if you're aware, but there was a HBO special called Luck that was very ill-fated and had to be canceled because the horses in the movie that they were filming at Santa Anita Racetrack, too many horses were dying and they had to cancel the series. And I went out to Santa Anita and talked to the fellow who was the point man for HBO. And he said they didn't know what they were doing. They didn't understand that horses aren't machines and they kept shooting the same scenes of racing over and over again. So of course the horses couldn't take it. So I thought, well, the real agency in America that does, whose mission is to protect horse racing, TRPB, Thoroughbred Racing Protection Bureau, would be a perfect place for Nikki to be subcontracted and watch the horses and make sure that they're safe. But of course, being a mystery thriller, there's many, many more things that are uncovered that are going on at Santa Anita that put her in danger.
Hence the line, keeping thoroughbreds safe from a director who doesn't know a horse from a hamster is tricky. Yes. She's good. You mentioned, obviously, the protection of horses and so on there. We still have folk who obviously, maybe for the best of intentions, maintain that horse racing is a cruel sport. I mean, any thoughts on that, Sasa?
Well, I can understand why people feel that way. And when I was young and gung-ho and everything was perfect, I thought, oh, how ridiculous that people are against it. But as I got older and I had one of my racehorses break down on the track, and I saw other things that were going on, you know, you do change your mind a little. And I'm so glad that they're restricting some of the drugs and that the TRPB and other organizations do go after trainers that use painkillers and things that will allow the horse to run when they're already injured. So if they keep on in that direction and they can't, they make more and more drugs illegal, and you can't race with them, I think things will get better. I think there will be less breakdowns. And it's such a wonderful sport. I mean, it's so historical and so beautiful, the pageantry, the colors, the spirit of the horses. I would hate to see it disappear.
Well, certainly there's a reason it was referred to as the sport of kings, although I appreciate in the United States you got rid of the king, King George III, so what the hey. You know, it could be the sport of presidents, maybe, maybe not, I don't know. In terms of characters, of course, I mean, we talked about Nikki Luttrell, but also equally, almost neck and neck, the final furlong, we've got Baltimore Police Officer Fia McKee, who was obviously featured in Flamingo Road, and indeed also has her investigation in terms of horse racing, where she's sent undercover to Saratoga Racetrack on the dark side of town. Given the choice between Fia McKee and Nikki Luttrell, any particular favorite? It's a case of
I couldn't possibly choose. Fia is more mature, older than Nikki. Nikki still has some of the problems and issues that she had when she was younger. And I want to keep her that way. But Fia is more grown up and she's a different woman. That's why at the end of the book, she's the one that shows up with the gun. that needs to be used. Because Nikki's never fired a gun. She doesn't even know how to use a gun. So they are two pretty different characters. But I enjoyed writing all of the books, and it was really fun to put the two of them together in Shooting Star.
One of the questions we always have for authors of multiple narratives and so on is, does it matter if we jump straight in with full mortality, or should we start with Racing with Evil? Is there a sort of way or a suggestion that you would say, yes, start at the beginning, otherwise you'd be completely lost?
No, you won't be completely lost. Each book was written as a standalone so that it could stand alone. But it's fun to start with the prequel, which is called Racing from Evil. And that's free. The ebook is completely free. And it's a novella, but it does give you the background of Nikki before she became a jockey. And it's a fun read, and it's gotten tremendously good reviews on Amazon and Goodreads.
Which proves it's you're well on the way to writing the Great American Novel, even though you claim that you never wanted to write the Great American Novel. It's okay, Sasa. I suspect that neither F. Scott Fitzgerald nor indeed Herman Melville also set out intending to write the Great American Novel, and look what happened there. So there you go.
Well, you never know.
In terms of the range of obviously transmedia storytelling, are plans afoot for Nikki Luttrell and indeed possibly Fia to have filmic or indeed televisual incarnations, or are we just sort of holding it to the printed word at present?
Oh, I would love to have someone that was interested in making a film out of the Nikki Luttrell series. And where all these people on Facebook, I have like 5,000 fans on Facebook, and they're all saying, why don't they make a movie out of this or a series? And I always say, well, do you know somebody? And they always go, no. So, you know, if you don't know somebody or know somebody that knows somebody in that world, you're dead. And so, you know, if something happens, that would be great. If it doesn't, I enjoy writing my books and I enjoy getting them out. And, you know, one recent book that I did write was, I stepped away from horse racing and wrote a book about the Irish American travelers. And that just was nominated for a Silver Fashion for Best Mystery of 2020. And actually the next book I'm going to write will be a sequel to that one. And then I will go back to either Nikki or Fia. So there actually are three series going.
And presumably Travels of Quinn is another sort of aspect which relates to that, and again defined as a mystery thriller of deceit, murder, greed and hope, but not too many horses in there, at least. Although, well, actually there are horses.
Yes, there are those gorgeous gypsy vanners. I mean, I thought, well, if she's a gypsy, which Irish American travelers are gypsies, then why not have gypsy vanners? I mean, it just sort of made sense. So I did put those in the book, but the horses definitely take a back seat in that book to the world of the Irish American traveler and their peculiar lifestyle, and how this gal, Quinn, wants to get out. It's a very insulated society. And they're known as con artists. I mean, they do a lot of things that are illegal. Like a typical thing was they paint, they do roofing, and a typical story was they went and painted the front half of a house and got the money and then left. And what they do is they have false ID and false licensing, and everything's false, false, false. So if you try to track them down to get your money, forget about it. You can't do it. So it's an interesting world. And I thought that it, and since they're centered right here, 40 minutes from my house, it was, it just seemed like the thing to do.
Indeed, exploring ethics and morals as well. Sasa, one of the things that we're constantly being asked to inquire of authors is, in terms of writing discipline, do you have any particular aspects? I mean, do you say, yes, before 10 a.m. strikes on the morning, I always like to have at least 2,000 words written, or is it a case of you go with the flow?
I go with the flow. I know there are gals on our national organization called Sisters in Crime that they get together like at 10 or 9 o'clock in the morning, and they all write for 2 hours, and that's not me. I just In fact, sometimes I do procrastinate, like all writers do procrastinate a little. And sometimes I trick myself. I say, well, no, you don't need to write, 10 pages a day, but why don't you just write a paragraph? Or just go back and fix up what you wrote yesterday and then write the beginning of the next chapter. And then next thing I know, it's like 3 hours later and I've written up a whole bunch of pages. So that works. I fool myself, so to speak.
Do you have any particular authors that you're inspired by at all? I mean, are you a Dick Francis aficionado person? Very much so.
Yeah. I loved Dick Francis, but I also like some of the American mystery writers. I love Michael Connelly. I love Robert Craze. Their style just really, really appeals to me because they have emotion in there and some beautiful writing. Robert Craze, from time to time, will write a sentence that just, to me, is fabulous. There are a number that I like. George Pelicanos, who's a pretty rough, dark writer about the DC area. I've enjoyed his books, even though they're quite dark. And I'm not a cozy mystery fan. I know Amazon insists upon putting cozy animal mystery next to some of my books, and I'm thinking, but it's not a cozy. So it's interesting. I like male writers a lot. I actually prefer many male writers to female writers, and I'm probably shooting myself in the foot by saying this, but that is how I feel.
And looking back to the horse racing world, have you ever actually looked at the international area? Do you sort of see what's happening in the United Arab Emirates, in Hong Kong, in Paris, in England? Or is it a case of, no, I stay with the United States of America?
No, I love watching the races in Europe and the Dubai World Cup. And when California Chrome, I don't know if you remember that horse, went over to Dubai and ran second in the big Dubai race, and then came back to America and went again the next year and won, I was just beside myself because I really liked California Chrome. I followed him closely back in the day. And I don't have as much time as I used to, but I will again, and I want to start following horse racing again. I've had some health problems in the last year that have slowed me down, but I've gotten through those. So I plan to be watching racing in England. I love to watch the Grand National. I mean, that is the most fabulous race. I love it.
Yeah. Well, having been at Aintree a few years ago, and we used to do various location reports there, I can certainly attest to the fact that it has a certain sparkle in its area and its overall system from that point of view. In terms of the pandemic, I mean, we need to mention it, of course, 18 months and counting, although still sort of heading through from that point of view. Some writers that we've spoken to have often said that actually it was ideal, it was heaven sent, a real opportunity to get writing. And then others said, well, I had all these intentions, all these good intentions, but didn't manage to engage any of them. How did it impact yourself?
Well, during much of the pandemic, I was being treated for cancer, which is the health thing I mentioned. But the thing I found out about the pandemic is that, yes, I could write between treatments, and that my books were selling because people were at home and they were reading books. I mean, they couldn't go anywhere. And a lot of the things that are up on Netflix, some of the programs I have on Netflix to me are terrible. And I not even watchable. Some of the stuff coming out of Australia is great. And I love the British crime series that I've been able to find on Netflix and Amazon Prime. But my experience with the pandemic was that I can write, but the best part is that books are selling.
Excellent. Which is, and long may they continue to do so. And I'm sure as the quality is of Sasa Hill and it has that Sasa Hill seal of approval, they will continue to do so. Sasa, it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with your good self today. Presumably, people who wish to get in touch with your good self, best one-stop shop would be sasahill.com.
Yes, absolutely. And there you can find the page for books, and then that lists all my books with very nice little red things that you click on those and it goes right to all the sales locations. And I do Amazon, Barnes and Noble, Kobo for people in Canada, and Apple iBooks are selling well.
Fantastic. And just a reminder, it's SASSERHILL. That's sasserhill.com from that point of view. Yes. Sasa, it's been fantastic connecting with your good self. We're going to wrap up with two standard questions, really. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today as our author of the week?
Yes, I am delighted at the care and time you took to investigate author Sasser Hill. Your questions have been wonderful, and I've enjoyed talking to you more than I can say. I just wish that the video part had worked, but I think I'm getting a new computer next week, and then I know everything will work.
Well, it is radio, but I'll switch on the camera now, so you can at least see that we have the Sasser Hill photograph in the back for the benefit of the radio listener, and of course, Flamingo Road, the awesome prize-winning novel there as well. So we saw you briefly. I mean, we could actually see you, but I figured that doing a radio interview via lip reading was not necessarily going to be the best way forward, particularly as neither of us could actually hear any of the responses either. So it would not necessarily been the best way forward, but we got there in the end. So the next critical question is, Sasser Hill, will you be kind enough to return?
I would love to return because you are absolutely marvelous. I've done many, many interviews and I've enjoyed talking to you more than 90% of the people I've interviewed. You're terrific.
Well, Sasser, we appreciate that. Take care and keep on keeping on. Stay safe, be well, and keep on writing.
And you too. Stay safe.
Time for another Zoomer on the Midweek Drive for Siren Radio and southsidebroadcasting.podbeam.com. Keeping the COVID-19 bugs at bay.
It's often been said that pain is nature's way of saying something's going wrong. And indeed, certainly pain does have lots of very important uses in our life. But when it comes to actually suffering from pain on a day-by-day situation, and it can be chronic pain and so on, clearly it becomes a misery. Now, clearly, one of the other aspects that occurred in the 20th century is, well, that's okay. There'll be a pill that can take care of that. And of course, Big Pharma has made huge profits with respect to that magical bullet solution and so on. But maybe, just maybe, technology could provide us with another way. And to talk us through the aspects of how maybe there is another way that's actually opening up in terms of the whole system and will address this opioid crisis that we're facing, we're delighted to welcome to the program now leading consultant in pain management and neuromodulation, and indeed a leading pain consultant in a pain consultancy case studies. That's Dr. Dominic Hegarty. How are you, Dominic?
Very well, thank you very much, and it's great to be chatting to you. Thank you. And well, you're right, your introduction is great there. I mean, that this, you just put it on the head. That is the problem. We've been looking for so long for tablets and medication to do the trick, but we've now learned that that's not completely the right way to go.
I mean, clearly that whole notion of people who have been suffering from addictions and a whole range of things, etc., it's not great. So what is the alternative there? I mean, looking at some of the figures here, 28 million British folk currently living with acute and chronic pain, 1 in 10 people living with pain that's in some way disabling them. What is this technology thing that could actually start alleviating some of these symptoms?
Yeah. Very good. Well, firstly, it works very simply on the principle of pain, and pain travels from one spot to another through nerves. And if you can intersect it, you can begin to close off the signal going from one to the other. But that's not a particularly new idea. In fact, if you go back historically, back into the 1960s, this was the theory of pain management, of the gate theory, where you literally close the signal using something else. That might have been medication, it might be massage, acupuncture, but now with technology and intersecting that using a specific form of wave nature that penetrates below the level of the skin and then makes the impact on the nerves that are going on a day-to-day basis has proved very useful indeed. And the evidence and the data that is there is that it stops the signal, it can impair the signal traveling for prolonged periods of time as well. So it's not just as you wear it that you need to have it on. It can have this impact long-term, maybe up to a couple of hours, 6 to 8 hours on average in the studies we were looking at. People were able to get by up comfortably from that point of view. And sometimes people even got a little bit longer. So it really did depend on where you place it, the nature of it itself. And that's what makes this technology a bit different in that it's drug-free, but it's also very flexible. An individual can use it anytime they wish to, or as much or as little as they want. But technically 30 minutes does enough treatment to give you several hours of relief. And of course, that's a fantastic relief for someone who's struggling on day to day, who's watching the clock, as I say, when the next tablets are due, and that they can get on and do their life, get their life back in order a little bit.
We're in the middle of Pain Awareness Month, of course. The World Health Organization's attempts to raise public awareness and understanding of pain. As I said, there are certain positives about pain, and we might say we need pain and so on. You don't want to eliminate everything from that point of view and be comfortably numb. But this particular BioWave Go, as you just described it, is it a way of actually ensuring that maybe for a change, we're not simply having to resort to taking more pills to actually overcome challenges in our lives?
Yes, absolutely. And I think originally, and if you look at the early phase of this, it's very popular in the elite athletes who suffer an acute injury, a strain, a muscle, ankle, etc. And they respond very quickly and get back onto the playing field or their track and field events very quickly. And we've lots of various, you know, team sports in the US have been very strong in this area. So it definitely addresses the first element, that acute or subacute window, very much. But it also, and this is where I became very interested, is what would this do for an individual who has it on a more regular basis, not the acute? Have we gone through the phase? And it certainly acts into that area as well. And again, it's not surprising because many of the things we do in the pain world is exactly to this element, either with injections or maybe other forms of more advanced or much more invasive technology. But this gets the match right between the regular bit where you can control the situation and give people the relief. Undoubtedly, pain is there for a reason, but there's also a point when it comes to, you know what, we don't need pain. I don't need to know that my knee is a bit sore today. I know about it. There's nothing inherently wrong with it, but it just is wear and tear, osteoarthritic changes, etc. We know these phrases. You see them mantled around all of the time, and that's important as well to realize it. But I suppose it's good to say, Alex, given what you've pointed out about the awareness month, you know, if you have a new pain, you need to make sure that it is what you think it is. Get it assessed properly, at least with primary care GP or even a physio to guide you. And then once that gets the clear head, the clearness to go, then absolutely tools like this are more important than ever to give us the control we want.
BioWave Go has been trialed over the last 12 months. It's had some tremendous success. 8 out of 10 people have actually found that it's reduced the pain they're experiencing by up to 50 or 60%. I mean, those are significant results.
Absolutely. I mean, if I said to someone, I'll give you a tablet and you'll get 30% relief from it, they'd probably say, please, can I do that? That's great. Would you have this reliability? And probably one of the advantages of this is the ability of the individual to have control over the situation. They're not feeling that they're under pressure to make the time slots. And that's a big thing when you know pain patients, and you know pain, how it impacts. It's the way that's stripped away from people, the ability to say, I can do this, I can control the pain rather than the pain controlling me. That's a massive impact on it. So just even physically, that's a very important aspect to it. But quite rightly, it's very clear. You look at the results, the pain intensity goes down. And simple markers like, were the individuals who were doing this type of work, did they cut back on their tablets? Yes, they did. Did they sleep a bit better? Yes, they did. And did their mood improve? Yes, they did. So it's not just the pain gone. It's all the other collateral damage that can go around a chronic pain patient improves as well. And in some respects, they're unbelievably valuable for an individual, but also for their family around them as well. Because if you're in a better place, everybody seems to benefit from it. And that has to be good for all of us.
And again, particularly interesting in terms of it's good for wrists, elbows and shoulders. So all sort of joint areas that are sort of open to pain from that. Can it also impact things like repetitive strain in injuries, aspects relating to that? I mean, I'm conscious that that is a sort of relatively recent phenomenon. Does that also get a benefit from this?
Absolutely. I think it's almost perfectly designed for it because there's a specific types of pads that you can actually, or pad sizes, to focus the energy from these energy sources to change the frequency pattern to really counterbalance it. So yes, that's a big feature. You can really tailor the treatment down to it to pick out very, very specific areas. And you're quite right. You're seeing more of these now with the more people working from home, more people Zooming than ever before and doing all these activities and clicking, etc. And it can be very focused. And, you know, it gives you the bit of control to it. And that type of injury you've described is almost tailor-made for this because that reflects an irritation of a relatively small peripheral or accessible nerve. So why should I have to treat my whole body with something it doesn't need just to get that element? It's focusing in. And that's the that's the real bonus to it itself. And the impact, you know, financially as well, is of course you're not having to queue up and go to physios and acupuncture therapies, because you're able to do it yourself and you can do it when you need it. And that's very, very important as well. So very focused, and that's one of the beauties of this device. It's that kind of discreet mechanism to offer flexibility, non-invasive, drug-free approach, and can make the impact.
So how can people find out more details about BioWave Go?
Yeah, there's an active website, the biowavego.co.uk website, has lots of information, and people will see the equipment there and maybe some how it's been used and the backup to it itself. It's readily available in that respect. So I'd encourage people just to take a look, see does it suit them, see is the kind of approach that's there. I say it's almost risk-free because it's not involving any systemic. So it's a great tool, and I think it should be something that people look at, you know, very seriously indeed. And I hope it would help people.
Dr. Dominic Hegarty, a consultant in pain management and neuromodulation. Huge thanks. Fascinating insight. And hopefully we'll speak again sometime.
Looking forward to it already. Thank you, Alex. Thank you.
It's a traditional statement that goes something along the lines of, if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And yet, despite that, it still seems as though there are many folk falling victim to fraud. And indeed, targets are obviously there in all sorts of ways when it comes to financial matters and so on. Now, when we look at recent findings, which suggest that 91% of university students are worried about their financial situation, and 32% would consider opportunities to make easy money, even if suspicious, clearly there are issues to be addressed here. And we're pleased to be able to talk to two fine folk, one of whom who tragically was actually a victim of fraud herself, and is the fantastic Georgia Steele. How are you, Georgia?
Hello, thank you for having me. I'm very good, thank you.
Excellent. Now, would you like to just share with us your particular experience of how you were a victim of fraud, conned by... obviously an ex-boyfriend?
Yes, so unfortunately this was like a couple of years ago. It was literally not something that you would ever expect to happen to yourself, and it was a very eye-opening experience and something I now like to reflect on, to able to show people that it is so easy to become a victim of fraud. And these guys that go out there and do fraud and commit this dreadful crime are very, very, very clued up in what they do, and they're professionals. And you don't have to be naive, you don't have to be silly or stupid to fall victim to this. Like, it is a case of just being at the wrong place at the wrong time, I truly believe. And I think just making people aware of it is the most important thing, and educating people on the things that might contribute to you being a victim.
Now, you're a bright individual. Clearly, you were still suckered into this process. Just talk us through what exactly happened and how basically somebody who wasn't even the person he claimed to be actually managed to clone your cards and remove thousands from your account.
Yes. So obviously it was someone that I met quite briefly, and his posterior was very much high end. It, like, to me, it would be like the last person that was ever to be a criminal or fraud stuff as such. Totally became quite a trustworthy relationship. And the persona he gave off would make you believe that he would have been the last person that would ever clone your cards, because you were made to feel like you wouldn't ever need to do that. So it was a very overwhelming, traumatic experience, to say the least, and something that I really didn't expect. And then obviously when it came out into the press and everything, and things were addressed to me that I had no knowledge of, it was very, very shocking and very confusing, to say so the least, because it was like I became to know a character that was made rather than an actual real individual. Mm.
Now, that's one very salient aspect in terms of cards being cloned and so on. We've also got on the line at present a fine soul from the Nationwide Building Society, where he's head of, I'd like to say, investigating fraud as opposed to just head of fraud. Ed Fisher, how are you, Ed?
Good morning. Yes, I'm fine. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, you've listened to George's story there. I mean, clearly something which is just completely well beyond the pale. How common actually is that in terms of cards being cloned, in terms of people pretending that they're not who they say they are? Or was it just a case of, well, Georgia was on Love Island, so obviously she must be an easy target?
Well, I think Georgia's story is really, it's really a horrible one, isn't it? And it just goes to show that actually, unfortunately, anybody can become a victim. I mean, it's still worth pointing out that, you know, in the UK, this is still, you know, the exception. You know, we don't want people to be frightened of meeting new folk and, you know, and getting on with their lives. But the fraudsters are out there. They are out there and they are targeting people. And as Georgia said, it kind of can actually happen to anybody. But one of the things we're really trying to raise awareness of is when you think of things like scams and tricks and you know, con artists, you tend to think of the sort of more traditionally vulnerable people, maybe somebody who's a bit more elderly or maybe somebody who's a relative. And that's true. They can become a victim. They absolutely can be. You could be tricked into sending your, you know, your pension or something somewhere where you don't think it's going. However, the thing we're really trying to raise awareness of at the moment, which Georgia's really helping in terms of, you know, the story that's happened to her, is for every victim from that sense as a sender, there needs to be somewhere for the money to go. So the mule, if you like, is the one that's carrying the money. And we're trying to raise awareness that these mules, they're not actually criminals themselves. That they're usually sort of kind of younger people with a bit less experience of the financial system. They're people who maybe, as you mentioned in your intro there, they're looking for some money. They might be promised a job, or they might be promised a cut of some money that's coming into their account. And it's that type of thing we want to raise awareness of, because two-thirds of students from that same survey, two-thirds didn't even know what a money mule was. So that's what makes them this target. We want to make sure they understand how to stop themselves from becoming a money mule and potentially receiving stolen goods.
Back in the day, of course, mules were often regarded in terms of the narcotics industry as people who might actually smuggle in various drugs in their stomach and all sorts of other areas of that which could end up in tears, and lots of tales that have emerged from that. Is it because of the financial situation that we have today, where it is so easy, literally with a couple of clicks, to just transfer our finances from one thing to the other, does that also increase the chances of people saying, yeah, actually, why don't you just let me transfer this into your account, and then we'll give you a nice percentage profit just for the purposes of doing so?
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head, really. It's in the modern day, things are so easy, and it's very easy to think that after a bit of money has come in, gone out and been transferred, that it's gone. But of course, you've got to remember there's a digital record, there's a trace and a trail. And what you know, you really don't want to get yourself involved, even unwittingly, you know, in anything like that, because you don't know where the money's from. You don't really know what it's the proceeds of. It could, in some circumstances, be, you know, something that's really quite grim. You know, this money can fund human trafficking and things like that in modern day slavery. And you absolutely don't want to get yourself caught up in any kind of gang that's involved in anything really terrible like that.
Georgia, this is very much the nightmare scenario. I mean, how have you managed to work through the process yourself? Yeah. I mean, you know, clearly you've gone through shock, denial, all the usual sort of lines from that point of view. Have you managed to turn the corner?
Yeah, definitely. I would say there was shock and denial there for the first couple of weeks for sure. And I'm very, very lucky. I have a very close family and we're very close. So I had a really good support system throughout that ordeal. But I definitely would say time's a good healer. And now, like being 2 years on from it, I use that as a positive, to be honest. And like Ed said, I think it's so important to share awareness. Obviously, I can connect a bit to these students as I am only 23 myself. Students are normally around 18 to 23. So I just feel like before the situation happened to me, I didn't have the awareness. And I feel like what's important is getting that awareness across to people. So if that means using my ordeal to help other people not go through what I did, then so be it. Let's turn a negative into a positive, I guess.
Mm. It's also worth noting that even if you do agree to allow your account to be used as part of a scam, you can face a sentence of 14 years in prison.
Yes, so, correct.
There are sort of major issues there.
And also, if you're a mule as well, you your account will be, without you even knowing, your account will be stopped, and it can be really difficult to open a new account regarding like student loans. That can be life changing for some people, and I just think people need to be aware of the circumstances of ever getting wrapped up in a crime like this. It can be literally life changing.
Ed, turning back to yourself again, it's interesting to see that 23% of adults said that they wouldn't carry out any checks about possible sort of money projects they're asked to get involved with, compared to just 8% of students who would. What advice would you generally have for students and indeed non-students who might be listening to this in terms of avoiding this situation? Just literally a case of, look, if you're asked to do this, just step away from it immediately.
Yeah, well, you've highlighted that the really encouraging part of this survey is that, as you say, you know, students in particular, these are bright people. They're absolutely understanding that there could be risks, and they're prepared to do some research. So I think the two key pieces of advice that we provide is that, you know, that there's the scammer, whatever the particular story, there's very, very often a financial incentive. There's some kind of reward. I mean, what one example might be, you know, a case that I was just sort of looking at earlier. Somebody was responding to a job ad on Snapchat. And this is quite a young individual. It appeared genuine, that it appeared that there was going to be something they could do from home involving trading in cryptocurrency. But actually, it wasn't anything like what they thought it was. And when it came to it, they were just being asked to take money in and move money on. They contacted us very quickly. And they did absolutely the right thing and helped make sure that there was a proper investigation, that, you know, we could trace what was going on. But it just goes to show, it's that sort of, as you say, it's the old adage, if it seems too good to be true, if it's too easy, if it's too straightforward, you know, it probably is. It really probably is. And that's a pretty big red flag. The second thing that's really, really important for people to remember is it might not be a job ad. It might not be a financial incentive. It might be some sort of friend of a friend or some sort of random request on social media that starts to turn into asking you to do something with money. Maybe someone has a story that they're stranded, or a relative needs you to help them, you know, get home. They're in an airport and they can't use their card or something. That kind of thing is a big red flag, because there's just no reason in the modern day for that to be true. You know, if there's a problem with someone's account, that'll get fixed very, very quickly by their bank, you know, possibly even in minutes, maybe just a couple of hours. So there's no reason to ever have to actually receive and move money. And if that's what you're asked to do, receive and move money, you've got to be highly sceptical, because that really is a huge red flag to being a mule.
Keywords. Georgia, are there any other thoughts or advice you'd give to any young people who might be heading off to university, looking forward to their first freshers week, etc., and might well sort of find themselves in this too good to be true situation?
Yeah, like, I obviously want to share a light on the fact that you need to go and have fun. Like, you want to go and talk to people and meet new people. You're at freshers, that's what freshers is about. But just have your wits about you, like, and educate on it. Nationwide have got a brilliant website where it shows the things that you need to look out for to make yourself not a victim of being a money mule, and just educate yourself on it so you have that knowledge behind you with going into a situation where you could be an easy target for a crime like this.
Georgia Steele, former Love Island contestant, of course, and all around wonderful soul, many thanks.
Likewise. Thank you so much. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Ed Fisher from Nationwide Building Society, thanks to you, good souls. Be well, be safe, and keep saving people's money accounts.
Thank you.
So the staycation. A few years ago, you might have thought, what's a staycation? Now it's become a standard way of experiencing holiday breaks close to home, shall we say, in terms of quite literally staying at home and having a vacation at home. Is it likely to be diminishing in popularity? Probably not, according to HoSeasons, but we don't stay just with one survey. We like to actually find out exactly what's happening. So we're delighted to actually feature travel expert extraordinaire back with us again. Of course, it's Lisa Minot. How are you, Lisa?
Morning, I'm good, thank you. You?
Good. Now, talk to us a little bit about this rise in popularity of staycations. Is it just because we can't be doing with all of these forms, testing, all the other sort of elements to go overseas? It's enough already. We're just going to stay at home.
Yeah, I mean, there definitely was very much. That was part of the thought process for many people this summer. You know, we had the traffic light system and these lights changing every 5 minutes. And we had, you know, quite onerous testing as well. It was going to be very expensive if you were a family to head abroad this summer. And there was the worry that perhaps your, you know, destination country would go on to the red list or amber list. And it definitely made a lot of people decide, right, we're going to stick with a holiday here at home. But what's interesting about this host season's research is the fact that 83% of those who did holiday at home in the UK this year are planning on doing so again next year. I think we've rediscovered just how great Britain is.
Mm. And one of the other elements, of course, which might be part of the rationale is the cost of the environment, because clearly if you're not jetting off around the world and adding to your carbon footprint, then given the current concern with respect to climate change, etc., maybe it's better to actually stay at home. Would that possibly feed into people's choices?
I mean, I think it's definitely a consideration now. We're all becoming much more aware of climate issues. And, you know, there is so many really fantastic, sustainable ways to travel in the UK. You know, people can take trains now. It doesn't even have to be a car. And there's plenty of places that are nearby that you can go and discover. But what surprised me about this research from Host Seasons was that actually this summer they found people travelled up to 317 miles for their staycation. So, you know, we're still looking to discover different parts of the UK. You know, it's very much a case of, you know, people wanting to see different horizons after the year we've had.
And what did holidaymakers find most enjoyable about holidaying in the UK? Because for so many years, if you were actually staying in the United Kingdom, you were almost looked at as being a peculiar soul, basically saying, oh, bless, you know, they just don't want to actually sort of go abroad and test new things out. What were the positives? Was it just discovering new golden nuggets of the country that we haven't experienced before?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think there was very much this sort of smug, I've just come back from the most amazing X place, that you were able to tell your friends and family about. Because, you know, people did desperately want a change of environment. We'd been locked down for many months, and a staycation gave us an opportunity to, you know, get out there, discover new places. But I think also, you know, the Host Seasons survey found that there's a nostalgia element to it as well. People really wanted to rediscover the holidays of their childhood, you know, the sort of fish and chips on the beach, and doing that with friends and family who perhaps they've been apart from for many months because of lockdown. I think it was the best of all worlds for people.
Probably around about 160, 170 years ago since people started discovering the joys of going off to the coast and other areas. And then, of course, in the 1930s, we had the establishment of the holiday camps and so on. Do you feel that Britain's ready to actually accommodate more staycationers? Do you feel that actually this is good news for the tourism industry as far as the UK is concerned?
Oh, very definitely. I mean, I think what's also a surprise for many people this summer is just the breadth of different types of accommodation that we have out there. You know, and also the standard of the accommodation. We're talking now about the fact that, you know, you've got beautiful lodges with hot tubs. We did a story in the paper this year, £500,000 caravan, you know, the sort of, so, you know, there are some fantastic ways to explore the UK that doesn't mean that it's a sort of lesser option. And there's lots of luxury out there. There's lots of amazing things you can see and do in a lot of style.
That's a whole new take on glamping, I would have thought, in terms of the £500,000 caravan or whatever. But still, in terms of looking towards the winter, I mean, I hear the term sleighcation, that's S-L-E-I-G-H, as in sleigh ride, is being bandied about. Is that also going to be pretty much the status symbol of the next few months, or a case of Gestart and various other foreign vacations and skiing? No, we're going to stay at home.
Yeah, I mean, very much so. This Host Seasons research found that 22%, one in five of us, are planning a slaycation. And I think what I've seen from my perspective as a travel journalist is the number, rising the number of events that happen now at Christmas. The sort of these light trails around country parks and beautiful stately homes where they're doing light and laser shows. And then you've got also the, you know, the sort of the Hogwarts Express, or sort of, you know, these that train rides, and lots of different ways to see Santa across the UK. It's definitely something that has really developed, and I'm seeing far more of. And I think that's what's prompting this rise in people wanting to go on a slaycation.
It's like the whole United Kingdom becoming one grand theme park, which is probably sort of another sort of issue to be discussed and so on. What about yourself, Lisa? Do you have any particular favourite parts of the United Kingdom which you think, actually, I always quite like heading off to X, Y, or Z place?
For me, it's a couple of places, actually. The coast of Essex, I know it sounds, everyone seems to think Essex is just, you know, sort of like the south end, but actually they've got some stunning coastal settings in Essex. Mersey Island is a really real favourite of mine, fantastic seafood there. And also the Peak District. I've always loved the Peak District just for those just jaw-dropping views. One of my favourite places to go to as well.
And presumably hoseasons.co.uk would be the best place to go to find out further details about what we've been chatting about today.
That's right. I mean, I think one thing that really people do need to appreciate is that this now is the time to start looking and booking a holiday for 2022. And there's plenty of choice, plenty of different deals that you can find at hoseasons.co.uk.
Lisa Minot, travel expert extraordinaire. Keep on keeping on and enjoy your staycations, slaycations or other form of vacations.
Small town girl, Coca-Cola grin, honeysuckle skin, born beneath the ready sign of a strawberry moon. Small town girl shows up for her friends, crazy about the band. I was there when she first put away childish things. We had spring in our heels, unwavering forces, head first into the unknown. Like runaway horses in a fever till the end, and every step is a silver prayer in the face of a hard wind. You traded school for wedding rings and rent, invitation sent of you and him by a barn out on the edge of town. Small town girl, put your dreams on ice, never thinking twice. Some you'll surely forget and some that you never will. There's a promise in our stride, but we changed courses, head first into the unknown. Like runaway horses in a fever till the end, and every step is a silver prayer in the face of a hard wind. Like runaway horses, it's a long way back home again. With every step is a silver.